get a horse out here.
Right here.
Mr. Kepler?
Yes, sir.
May I please report? My name is Johnny Kepler. We are from the law firm of Galf, Johnson & Newman in St. Louis, Missouri. And we represent the party Bayshaw. The reason that we're here today, I think, is the two issues primarily. The first issue is the issue of collateral estoppel. Was it properly applied? And the second issue is whether the court properly found that the defendant's products were not infringed.
There's also an implied license issue, right? And the question is whether the implied license issue is part of the judgment against you. If you look at 8.2, this judgment that was entered seems to incorporate both the earlier magistrate judge's decision as approved by the district court and the September 10 order for judgment issued by Judge Horner. So I'm having trouble seeing why this judgment doesn't also rest on implied license.
Yes, Your Honor. If we look at the procedural background.
Well, let's talk first about the order.
And you okay.
Are you original about this order on 8.22, it seems to me explicit. This is the judgment entered by the clerk. Explicit is based both on the November 6, 2006 order and on the September 10, 2007. And the earlier one was based on implied license. This is the judgment entered by the court. It specifically rests on both, right?
Yes, that's what it says, yes. And the there was also the Judge Hornby vacated the judgment below and re-entered. Now, one reading of the word vacated is that the judgment below is now no longer of any standing, have any holding.
Well, of course the judge, the earlier judgment entered by the court doesn't have any standing, but he didn't vacate the November 6th decision, did he?
Not explicitly, no.
So, it's hard for me to read this judgment as doing anything other than resting on both the earlier decision in 2006 and the decision in 2007. Why am I wrong about that?
Well, I think the language that the court used in trying to sum up the rather confusing procedure below left it to said that it was vacated, said that the judgment below was vacated, and then entered another decision that seemed to have its own life, if you will, and we took that at its word.
Well, what Judge Hornby said was plainly the judgment on the counterclaim must be vacated under Federal Civil Procedure 68, this is at A1063. And then he says the plaintiff's motion for relief from judgment from the counterclaims is granted. That's all he said about vacating. He vacated with regard to the counterclaims. And the order, earlier judgment was based the order of November 2006 by Judge Gene Carter, said The defendant's motion for summary judgment on patent infringement is hereby granted, and alternatively, defendant's motion for summary judgment on exhausted implied license is hereby granted. So the question is, was that ever vacated? And it doesn't appear to be.
Well, it seems to have been superseded by the language of Judge Hornby when he refers to the counterclaims. I think we have to keep in mind that implied license was not part of the pleadings. It was first raised in the motion for summary.
Well, that's another question I was wondering about. It didn't seem to me that it came up either as an affirmative defense or as a counterclaim. It wasn't either of those. It was brought in by motion, wasn't it?
That's correct.
So how do we deal with it? So then there's a real question as to where in the judgment it sits. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
Why should we prefer your version of it than theirs, where it sits?
Well, I think the fact that you can ask the question of where does this implied license issue come in, perhaps answers the question that there is some ambiguity.
But you're not arguing that the implied license decision was not authorized in November of 2006, are you?
No, I'm not.
You're not. So, if it was authorized and the 2006 decision was adopted as part of the judgment here, it seems to me that it rests on implied license.
Well, Your Honor, perhaps if it had simply been adopted, that would have been sufficient. However, Judge Hornby went on to list, if you will.
It's not Judge Hornby who enters the judgment. It's the clerk that enters the judgment. And the judgment entered by the clerk on 822 rests both on Judge Hornby's decision and on the earlier decision, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, what about the invalidity issue? You say that there wasn't a full and fair opportunity to litigate. And are not those same issues being raised in the other appeal from the invalidity judgment?
You're referring to the Burton case? Yes.
Yeah, the same issues, right?
Yes.
So you'll have an opportunity in the context of that appeal to argue that the district court made an error in not allowing you to supplement the record and whatever else you're raising here, that summary judgment wasn't appropriate. All those issues that you're raising here, collaterally, are also an issue in the direct appeal from the invalidity determination.
That's correct, Your Honor. And if I am my opponent, if I try to argue that in the Burton case, I would say that, well, you're cut off from doing that because you've got this collateral estoppel.
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Well, the Burton I didn't say that correctly, I'm sorry. So let's say that we prevail in the Burton case. What happens to the case in Solomon?
Well, under the restatement, the judgment can be reopened if you prevail in the other case that led to the collateral estoppel. The Rule 60B motion allows you to set aside a judgment where a judgment rests on collateral estoppel. Basis for the collateral estoppel disappears because the other judgment is reversed.
Well, in that case, that's what we would do. I mean, we feel that the issue of collateral estoppel is an important issue here. We feel that not having been involved in the proceedings below, we know about this case much like you do from what was filed. And we see a situation here where there were two cases filed within about 9 days of each other, I believe. And looking back, I don't know why these cases weren't consolidated.
Well, that would be my question. If you think this collateral estoppel issue is an important one, why did you move to consolidate up here?
We did. We put that in our brief. As a relief.
In this case? You mentioned it, but you never moved to consolidate. You did mention there was another case And maybe it should have been consolidated, but then you blew that off and went up.
Well, that, and that's
unless I misread your brief.
No, that's our error, that we didn't, that we weren't more forceful in that statement than you. Because I think these cases should have been consolidated within a week of the two cases being filed in the district court of Maine.
What's the status of the other thing? Is the briefing still going on?
Briefing's done. There was a motion, there was a cross appeal filed by Burton et al. In that case, and that cross appeal, we filed a motion to dismiss it. That motion was granted, and it's another interesting issue procedurally because of that cross appeal. The Burton case then gets after the Solomon case when perhaps the better order would have been to just stay this case and decide Burton, since the Solomon case and the collateral estoppel hinges from the Burton case.
When is Burton going to be oriented?
We do not have a date yet.
It might have been good. It might also have been nice, and you moved to stay in this case because you were about to settle. Could have mentioned that to my help you get that continuance. That wasn't mentioned in that motion.
You know, I'll take responsibility for that, Your Honor, because I guess I wasn't sure how much communication there is between that settlement, those settlement discussions, and Your Honor's. So I didn't.
Well,
that was my misunderstanding. I would like to see that happen today. I would like to see mediation order. If there are no more questions, I'll step down. Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning. As the court aptly points out, there's three issues for decision here. One is respect to the waiver issues, whether or not the patent exhaustion.
You agree, don't you, that if you were to affirm in this case and the Burton case were to reverse the judgment of invalidity, that at least insofar as the invalidity judgment is involved here, it has to be set aside, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And I think procedurally for this court, there's a couple of options. One is we can wait, that this court can wait to decide this case after the Burton finding on invalidity is decided. That case is fully briefed. It has not yet been set for argument, but it will be. So that would be one way that we can avoid having the judgment entered by collateral estoppel here and then having to reopen it under Rule 60. Alternatively, if this court affirms the Solomon decision on one of the other bases, either non-infringement, which was found below, or non-infringement based upon the implied license or waiver, Solomon would agree to have the collateral estoppel decision on invalidity by anticipation vacated, because that issue is going to be decided in the Burton case. That patent will either be determined to be invalid or valid in that case. So here, again, if this court decides, this panel decides to affirm, below, we don't need to deal.
On other grounds, you're not going to push the validity issue. Is that what you're telling me?
Correct. Okay. Correct. Which would
that seems
would,
terribly fair.
Thank you. Now let's talk about the waiver issue, and I think that the court did point out that what was vacated here was not the ruling by the order that affirmed the recommended decision by the magistrate judge. That's the only findings of fact and conclusions in this case that were standing before you arguing the non-infringement issues on. If that was somehow vacated, well, what are we doing here? One. And two, as was pointed out, the only thing that was vacated was the counterclaims, was to the extent that the judgment implicated counterclaims at all, that judgment with respect to the counterclaims was vacated. Now, an issue was raised as to whether or not the issue of license was raised as an affirmative defense. And what was raised as an affirmative defense in this case was release. Because what happened here, and if you look at, I think it's A1110.
I don't think it was raised, I don't think they argued it was affirmative defense. They said, as the record suggests, that it brought in as a motion.
It was, but what I'm suggesting as the issue, although it was not cast as implied license as an affirmative defense, we cast it as release as an affirmative defense because what happened here below...
Are you saying that that issue is properly before us?
Yes. That it was raised as an affirmative defense.
Therefore, it's before us for decision.
It's not before us for decision because it was waived. It was still the waiver issue, but the issue that was pointed out was whether... The judgment
you say it was waived, where was it waived?
Let me start over, Your Honor. And with respect to the argument that was made by opposing counsel on the amended judgment, which is at A22, stating that on all counts of the complaint, the judgment was entered only on all counts of the complaint, and that the waiver issue that was briefed and decided below was not captured in the all counts of the complaint part of that judgment. Our position is it was raised as a count in the complaint because our implied license argument was raised as a release affirmative defense because that decision...
That seems a little thin, but I don't see what difference it makes. We've got a decision which was incorporated in your favor on implied license, which means that the count of the complaint seeking damages or other relief or infringement is null bill. And you had a decision saying that you win on that liability issue, and so what difference does it make whether it was an affirmative defense or however it was raised?
I agree. I was just responding to an argument, I believe.
I thought the problem was, and maybe I totally missed it, which is not a common point, but I thought the problem was that their statement of the issues which they raised on appeal, they didn't mention the license issue, which in effect means it's not appealed. Isn't that what all that's about, or am I missing something?
No, you're exactly right, Your Honor. They didn't raise it as an issue on appeal, and they didn't raise it in their opening brief on appeal. So therefore it's waived, and this court can affirm that the district court's decision in that case can get dismissed on the issue of implied license,
okay, good. Let's
all
focus,
by itself for not raising.
Let's focus on their paragraph 2 or issue number 2 in the statement of the issue. I assume they don't need to necessarily argue it in their brief if they state it as an issue on appeal, but I'm not exactly sure about that either. But in their second issue, statement of the issue in their blue brief, they say the first one is clearly collateral estoppel. The second one is, did the district court err in finding claim 8 of the 810 patent not infringed by defendant Appley's respective products? Could not infringed include the question barred by license?
It could, Your Honor, but they didn't brief and argue the bar by license here, but clearly decisions of this court have addressed the implied license patent exhaustion as non-infringement position. So they could have, but they didn't argue and provide this court with any argument as to why the court's decision on implied license, if you want to call it a non-infringement argument, should be overturned here. So they failed to raise and argue that issue on appeal.
Well, there's nothing here. They may have been unpersuasive, but that issue is before us, isn't it? Their argument may be a little thin, i.e. non-existent, but doesn't that keep the issue alive for appeal? I'm a little confused as to exactly what the status of that issue is. Your argument is that if they don't lay it out in their blue brief, they've waived it even if they've raised it as an issue on appeal.
Correct.
Do you have authority for that somewhere?
Not directly, Your Honor, but they've provided this court absolutely no basis, which they need to do in their brief, as to why. What was the error below on the implied license judgment?
So they haven't argued in the opening brief or in the reply.
Correct. It's void. The briefing before this court is void on the merits of whether or not, if this court determines that it was technically raised as a non-infringement issue or defense to a non-infringement defense, within this record for this court, it's completely void as to how you could reverse the district court's opinion. There's nothing at all on the merits.
Which would be a basis for our affirming the district court rather than saying that they waived, I suppose.
You could affirm it either way. One, that it was not appropriately raised to the court, and if you determine based on the non-infringement language that it was, the record's utterly void of any argument or basis upon which this court could change that decision.
That's all.
Now, we also have not yet discussed the non-infringement finding below. In this case, there was a limitation in Claim 8 of the 810 patent that requires a liner. And that liner limitation had been interpreted to require that the entire liner that's claimed, and this is a liner that could be used in a boot, shoe, or in clothing.
This is the breathability.
Yeah, that it needs to be breathable or permeable to water vapor. And the district court appropriately found that the plaintiff, Space Shop, failed in the burden of production of the summary judgment, at the time of summary judgment, to come forward with any evidence upon which a reasonable jury could determine that the entire liner in any of the accused...
It's the third layer that's the problem. It's the outer layer. It doesn't address the breathability.
The layer itself, he doesn't address the breathability at all.
Well, I don't think that's true. I think he does address the breathability of the first two.
Well, let's look at the evidence. There was only two, the only things that were submitted at all below on this issue was the expert report of Mr. Butterworth and excerpts from his
deposition. He talks about the inner moisture transfer rate. That's
breathability,
right?
Well, it isn't. That's a conclusion that's reading on Claim 8, which requires an inner moisture transfer material.
But if it's a transfer layer, it's breathable, right?
Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. And the issue here, Your Honor, is the sufficiency of that expert statement to provide the basis for non-infringement in front of a jury. And there's absolutely, this is pure conclusion. You can look at that, but that's the entire thing.
That's what it may be pure conclusion, but he does say that the inner layer is a moisture transfer layer. He does say that the first layer is breathable foam.
Exactly, correct.
Breathable foam. You may think it's conclusive, but he does say those two things. What he doesn't say, it seems to me, is that the third layer is breathable.
Correct. As pointed out, you'll see, also it talks about that there's an adhesive vehicle that is used to attach the layers of the liner here. In Claim 8, it's a liner comprising the three particular layers, but if there's other layers in between, whether it's an adhesive layer or any other type of layer, it's the liner in its entirety that needs to be breathable. And so there's no conclusion that the liner that consists of these three layers and additional layers, because it's a comprising claim, is breathable here. There's nothing in the record from which a jury could look at and say, yeah, that entire liner is breathable. It's devoid, and they failed to meet the burden of production on that issue here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Please, the court. I will continue with some comments about the issue of the applied license and the vacated judgment. Sean is going to go in another direction with this in my main 3 minutes. But if you look at let me propose that if the November 6, 2006 judgment was not wholly vacated, then why was a new judgment entered on the complaint?
the judgment was vacated. It's not what the decision was vacated. That's your problem.
Judge Hornby made a reference to some confusion. I'm not sure making any excuses here, but point that I want to make is that this has been a very confusing case, particularly for people who are reading the record and not having been involved. And even Judge Hornby mentioned, I believe, at one point that there had been some, he didn't use the word mistakes, and there probably weren't mistakes, but maybe some issues that weren't properly put down on paper. I don't know how best to put them.
You were not trial judge, I take it.
No, I was not.
You were you did prepare the brief.
Yes, sir.
When you prepared this brief, did you think you were raising the issue of the license specifically? And if so, why didn't you ever say anything?
We did not think we were. We did not because we didn't think that it was an issue because of the way the decisions and the judgments came from the court below. Anything else? All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All rise.